Chapter 9.
It is possible that our letters have crossed in the mail, but it does seem more likely that you simply do not wish to correspond. I accept that, and wish you well. I shan't bother you again. I hope you know that I am listening, should you ever change your mind. From the Earl of Kilmartin to the Countess of Kilmartin, 8 months after his arrival in India. It wasn't easy hiding his illness. The Tom didn't present a problem. Michael simply turned down all of his invitations, and Francesca put it about that he wished to settle in at his new home before taking his place in society. The servants were more difficult. They talked, of course, and often to servants from other households, so Francesca had had to make sure that only the most loyal retainers were privy to what went on in Michael's sick room. It was tricky, especially since she wasn't even officially living at Kilmartin House, at least not until Janet and Helen arrived, which Francesca fervently hoped was soon. But the hardest part, the people who were the most fiendishly curious and difficult to keep in the dark, had to be Francesca's family. It had never been easy maintaining a secret within the Bridgerton household, and keeping one from the whole lot of them was, to put it simply, a bloody nightmare.
"Why do you go over there every day?"
Hyacinth asked over breakfast.
"I live there,"
Francesca replied, taking a bite of a muffin, which any reasonable person would have taken as a sign that she did not wish to converse. Hyacinth, however, had never been known to be reasonable.
"You live here?"
she pointed out. Francesca swallowed, then took a sip of tea, the delay intended to preserve her composed exterior.
"I sleep here,"
she said coolly.
"Isn't that the definition of where you live?"
Francesca slathered more jam on her muffin.
"I'm eating, Hyacinth."
Her youngest sister shrugged.
"So am I, but it doesn't prevent me from carrying on an intelligent conversation." "I'm going to kill her,"
Francesca said, to no one in particular, which was probably a good thing, as there was no one else present.
"Who are you talking to?"
Hyacinth demanded.
"God,"
Francesca said baldly.
"And I do believe I have been given divine leave to murder you."
"Hm," was Hyacinth's response.
"If it was that easy, I'd have asked permission to eliminate half the Ton years ago."
Francesca decided just then that not all of Hyacinth's statements required a rejoinder. In fact, few of them did.
"Oh, Francesca!"
came Violet's voice, thankfully interrupting the conversation.
"There you are!"
Francesca looked up to see her mother entering the breakfast room, but before she could say a word, Hyacinth piped up with,
"Francesca was just about to kill me."
"Excellent timing on my part, then," Violet said, taking her seat. She turned to Francesca.
"Are you planning to go over to Kilmartin House this morning?"
Francesca nodded.
"I live there." "I think she lives here,"
Hyacinth said, adding a liberal dose of sugar to her tea. Violet ignored her.
"I believe I will accompany you."
Francesca nearly dropped her fork.
"Why?"
"I should like to see Michael," Violet said, with a delicate shrug.
"Hyacinth, will you please pass me the muffins?" "I'm not sure what his plans are today,"
Francesca said quickly. Michael had had an attack the night before, his fourth malarial fever to be precise, and they were hoping it would be the last of the cycle. But even though he would be much recovered by now, he would still most likely look dreadful. His skin, thank God, wasn't jaundiced, which Michael had told her was often a sign that the sickness was progressing to its fatal stage. But he still had that awful sickly air to him, and Francesca knew that if her mother caught one glimpse of him, she would be horrified and furious. Violet Bridgerton did not like to be kept in the dark, especially when it pertained to a matter about which one could use the term life and death, without being accused of hyperbole.
"If he's not available, I will simply turn around and go home," Violet said.
Jam, please, Hyacinth.
I'll come too,
Hyacinth said. Oh, God! Francesca's knife skittered right across her muffin. She was going to have to drug her sister. It was the only solution.
You don't mind if I come along too, do you?
Hyacinth asked Violet. Didn't you have plans with Eloise? Francesca said quickly. Hyacinth stopped, thought, blinked a few times.
I don't think so.
Shopping? At the milliner? Hyacinth took another moment to run through her memory.
No. In fact, I'm quite certain I don't. I just purchased a new bonnet last week. Lovely one, actually. Green, with the most cunning ecru trim.
She glanced down at her toast, regarded it for a moment, then reached for the marmalade.
I'm weary of shopping,
she added.
No woman is ever weary of shopping,
Francesca said, a touch desperately.
This woman is. Besides, the Earl...
Hyacinth cut herself off, turning to her mother.
May I call him Michael?
You'll have to ask him, Violet replied, taking a bite of eggs. Hyacinth turned back to Francesca.
He's been back in London an entire week, and I haven't even seen him. My friends have been asking me about him, and I don't have anything to say.
It's not polite to gossip, Hyacinth, Violet said.
It isn't gossip,
Hyacinth retorted.
It's the honest dissemination of information.
Francesca actually felt her chin drop. Mother, she said, shaking her head,
you really should have stopped at 7.
Children, you mean? Violet asked, sipping at her tea. Sometimes I do wonder.
Mother!
Hyacinth exclaimed. Violet just smiled at her. Salt?
It took her 8 tries to get it right,
Hyacinth announced, thrusting the salt cellar at her mother with a decided lack of grace. And does that mean that you, too, hope to have 8 children? Violet inquired sweetly.
God, no,
Hyacinth said, with great feeling. And neither she nor Francesca could quite resist a chuckle after that. It's not polite to blaspheme, Hyacinth, Violet said, in much the same tone she'd used to tell her not to gossip. Why don't we stop by shortly after noon? Violet asked Francesca, once the moment of levity had petered out. Francesca glanced up at the clock. That would give her barely an hour to make Michael presentable. And her mother had said, we, as in more than one person, as in she was actually going to bring Hyacinth, who had the capacity to turn any awkward situation into a living nightmare.
I'll go now,
Francesca blurted out, standing up quickly,
to see if he's available.
To her surprise, her mother stood also. I will walk you to the door, Violet said, firmly.
You will?
Yes. Hyacinth started to rise. Alone, Violet said, without even giving Hyacinth a glance. Hyacinth sat back down. Even she was wise enough not to argue when her mother was combining her serene smile with a steely tone. Francesca allowed her mother to precede her out of the room, and they walked in silence until they reached the front hall, where she waited for a footman to retrieve her coat. "Is there something you wish to tell me?" Violet asked.
I don't know what you mean.
I think you do.
I assure you,
Francesca said, giving her mother her most innocent look.
I don't.
You have been spending a great deal of time at Kilmartin House, Violet said.
I live there,
Francesca pointed out, for what felt like the 100th time. Not right now, you don't, and I worry that people will talk.
No one has said a word about it,
Francesca returned.
I haven't seen a thing in the gossip columns, and if people were talking about it, I'm sure that one of us would have heard by now.
Just because people are keeping quiet today doesn't mean they will do so tomorrow, Violet said. Francesca let out an irritated exhale.
It's not as if I'm a never-married virgin. Francesca!
Francesca crossed her arms. I'm sorry to speak so frankly, Mother, but it is true. The footman arrived just then with Francesca's coat and informed her that the carriage would be in front momentarily. Violet waited until he stepped outside to await its arrival, then turned to Francesca and asked, "What precisely is your relationship to the Earl?" Francesca gasped.
"Mother!"
"It is not a silly question," Violet said.
"It is the silliest, no, quite the stupidest question I have ever heard. Michael is my cousin."
"He was your husband's cousin," Violet corrected.
"And he was my cousin as well," Francesca said sharply. "And my friend. Good heavens, of all people, I can't even imagine. Michael."
But the truth was, she could imagine. Michael's illness had kept it all at bay. She'd been so busy caring for him and keeping him well that she'd managed to avoid thinking about that jolting moment in the park when she'd looked at him and something had sparked to life within her. Something she had been quite certain had died inside of her 4 years earlier. But hearing her mother bring it up, good God, it was mortifying. There was no way, no earthly way that she could feel an attraction to Michael. It was wrong. It was really wrong. It was, well, it was just wrong. There wasn't another word that described it better.
"Mother,"
Francesca said, keeping her voice carefully even,
"Michael has not been feeling well. I told you that."
7 days is quite a long time for a head cold.
"Perhaps it is something from India," Francesca said. "I don't know. I think he is almost recovered. I have been helping him get settled here in London. He has been gone a very long time, and as you've noted, he has many new responsibilities as the Earl. I thought it my duty to help him with all of this."
She looked at her mother with a resolute expression, rather pleased with her speech. But Violet just said, "I will see you in an hour," and walked away, leaving Francesca feeling very panicked indeed. Michael was enjoying a few moments of peace and quiet. Not that he'd been bereft of quiet, but malaria did little to allow a body peace when Francesca burst through his bedroom door, wild-eyed and out of breath.
"You have two choices," she said,
or rather heaved. "Only two," he murmured, even though he hadn't a clue what she was talking about.
"Don't make jokes."
He hauled himself into a sitting position. "Francesca," he asked gingerly, since it was his experience that one should always proceed with caution when a female was in a state. "Are you quite all—"
"My mother is coming," she said.
"Here?" She nodded. It wasn't an ideal situation, but hardly something deserving of Francesca's feverish demeanour. "Why?" he inquired politely.
"She thinks—"
She stopped, catching her breath.
"She thinks—" "Oh, heavens, you won't believe it."
When she didn't expound upon this any further, he widened his eyes and held out his hands in an impatient gesture, as if to say, "Care to elaborate?"
"She thinks,"
Francesca said, shuddering as she turned to him,
"that we are conducting an affair."
"After only a week back in London," he murmured thoughtfully, "I'm faster than I imagined."
"How can you joke about this?"
Francesca demanded. "How can you not?" he returned. But of course she could never laugh about such a thing. To her, it was unthinkable. To him, it was, well, something else entirely.
"I am horrified,"
she declared. Michael just offered her a smile and a shrug, even though he was starting to feel a little pricked. Naturally, he did not expect Francesca to think of him in such a manner, but a reaction of horror didn't exactly make a fellow feel good about his manly prowess. "What are my two choices?" he asked abruptly. She just stared at him. "You said I have two choices." She blinked, and would have looked rather adorably befuddled if he weren't a bit too annoyed with her ire to credit her with anything that charitable.
"I...
don't recall," she finally said.
"Oh, my heavens," she moaned. "What am I to do?"
"Settling down might be a good beginning," he said, sharply enough to make her head jerk back in his direction. "Stop and think, Franny. This is us. Your mother will realize how foolish she's being once she takes the time to think about it."
"That's what I told her,"
she replied fervently.
"I mean, for goodness sake, can you imagine?"
He could, actually, which had always been a bit of a problem.
"It is the most unfathomable thing,"
Francesca muttered, pacing across the room.
"As if I..."
She turned, gesturing to him with overblown motions.
"As if you..."
She stopped, planted her hands on her hips, then clearly gave up on trying to hold still and began to pace anew.
"How could she even consider such a thing?"
"I don't believe I have ever seen you quite so put out," Michael commented. She halted in her tracks and stared at him as if he were an imbecile, with two heads, and maybe a tail. "You really ought to endeavour to calm down," he said, even though he knew his words would have the exact opposite effect. Women hated to be told to calm down, especially women like Francesca.
"Calm down,"
she echoed, turning on him as if possessed by an entire spectrum of furies.
"Calm down! Good God, Michael, are you still feverish?"
"Not at all," he said coolly.
"Do you understand what I'm saying to you?"
"Quite," he bit off, about as politely as any man could after having his manhood impugned.
"It's insane," she said. "Simply insane. I mean, look at you."
Really, she might as well just grab a knife and apply it to his ballocks. "You know, Francesca," he said with studied mildness, "there are a lot of women in London who would be rather pleased to be, how did you say it, conducting an affair with me." Her mouth, which had been hanging open after her latest outburst, snapped shut. He lifted his brows and leaned back against his pillows. "Some would call it a privilege." She glared at him. "Some women," he said, knowing full well he should never bait her about such a subject, "might even engage in physical battle just for the mere opportunity."
"Stop," she snapped. "Good heavens, Michael, such an inflated view of your own prowess is not attractive."
"I'm told it's deserved," he said with a languid smile. Her face burned red. He rather enjoyed the sight. He might love her, but he hated what she did to him. And he was not so big of heart that he didn't occasionally take a bit of satisfaction in seeing her so tortured. It was only a fraction of what he felt on a day-to-day basis, after all.
"I have no wish to hear about your amorous exploits," Francesca said stiffly.
"Funny. You used to ask about them all the time." He paused, watching her squirm. "What was it you always asked me?"
"I don't..."
"Tell me something wicked," he said, using his best, trying to sound as if he'd just thought of it voice, when of course he never forgot anything she said to him. "Tell me something wicked," he said again, more slowly this time. "That was it. You rather liked me when I was wicked. You were always so curious about my exploits."
"That was before..."
"Before what, Francesca?" he asked. There was an odd pause before she spoke.
"Before this," she muttered. "Before now. Before everything."
"I'm supposed to understand that." Her answer was merely a glare. "Very well," he said. "I suppose I should get ready for your mother's visit. It shouldn't be too much of a problem." Francesca regarded him dubiously.
"But you look terrible."
"I knew there was a reason I loved you so well," he said dryly. "One really needn't worry about falling into the sin of vanity with you about."
"Michael, be serious."
"Sadly, I am." She scowled at him. "I can rise to my feet now," he told her, "exposing you to parts of my body I would imagine you'd rather not see. Or you can leave and await my glorious presence downstairs." She fled, which puzzled him. The Francesca he knew didn't flee anything. Nor, for that matter, would she have departed without at least making an attempt to get the last word. But most of all, he couldn't believe she had let him get away with calling himself glorious. Francesca never did have to suffer a visit from her mother. Not 20 minutes after she left Michael's bedchamber, a note arrived from Violet, informing her that her brother Colin, who had been travelling in the Mediterranean for months, had just returned to London, and Violet would have to postpone her visit. Then later that evening, much as Francesca had predicted at the onset of Michael's attack, Janet and Helen arrived in London, assuaging Violet's concerns about Francesca and Michael and their lack of a chaperone. The mothers, as Francesca and Michael had long since taken to calling them, were thrilled at Michael's unexpected appearance, although one look at his sickly features propelled both of them into maternal tizzies of concern that had forced Michael to take Francesca aside and beg her not to leave him alone with either of the two ladies. In truth, the timing of their arrival was rather fortuitous, as Michael had a comparatively healthy day in their presence, before being struck by another raging fever. Francesca had taken them aside before the next expected attack and explained the nature of the illness, so by the time they saw the malaria in all its horrible glory, they were prepared. And unlike Francesca, they were more agreeable, no, downright eager, to keep his malady a secret. It was difficult to imagine that a wealthy and handsome earl might not be considered an excellent catch by the unmarried ladies of London, but malaria was never a mark in one's favour when looking for a wife. And if there was one thing Janet and Helen were determined to see before the year was out, it was Michael standing at the front of a church, his ring firmly on the finger of a new countess. Francesca was actually relieved to sit back and listen to the mothers harangue him about getting married. At least it took their attention off of her. She had no idea how they would react to her own marital plans. She rather imagined they would be happy for her. But the last thing she wanted was two more matchmaking mamas attempting to pair her up with every poor, pathetic bachelor on the marriage mart. Good heavens, she had enough to put up with her own mother, who was surely not going to be able to resist the temptation to meddle once Francesca made clear her desire to find a husband this year. And so Francesca moved back to Kilmartin House, and the entire Stirling household turned itself into a little cocoon, with Michael declining all invitations with the promise that he would be out and about once he settled in from his long journey. The three ladies did occasionally go out in society, and although Francesca had expected questions about the new earl, even she was unprepared for the volume and frequency. Everyone, it seemed, was mad for the merry rake, especially now that he'd shrouded himself with mystery. Oh, and inherited an earldom. Mustn't forget that. Or the £100,000 that went with it. Francesca shook her head as she thought about it. Truly, Mrs. Radcliffe herself couldn't have devised a more perfect hero. It was going to be a madhouse once he was recovered. And then, suddenly, he was. Very well. Francesca supposed it wasn't that sudden. The fevers had been steadily decreasing in severity and duration. But it did seem that one day he still looked wan and pale, and the next he was his regular hale and hearty self, prowling about the house, eager to escape into the sunshine. "Quinine," Michael said with a lazy shrug, when she remarked upon his changed appearance at breakfast. "I'd take the stuff 6 times a day if it didn't taste so damned foul." "Language, please, Michael," his mother murmured, spearing a sausage with her fork. "Have you tasted the quinine, mother?" he asked. "Of course not." "Taste it," he suggested, "and then we'll see how your language compares." Francesca chuckled under her napkin.
"I tasted it," Janet announced.
All eyes turned to her.
"You did?"
Francesca asked. Even she hadn't been so daring. The smell alone had been enough for her to keep the bottle firmly corked at all times.
"Of course," Janet replied. "I was curious."
She turned to Helen.
It really is foul. Worse than that awful concoction cook made us take last year for the... Helen gave Janet a look that clearly meant, you know what I mean. Much worse, Janet affirmed. Did you reconstitute it? Francesca asked. The powder was meant to be mixed with purified water, but she supposed that Janet might have simply put a bit on her tongue. Of course. Aren't I supposed to?
Some people like to mix it with gin, Michael said. Helen shuddered.
It could hardly be worse than on its own, Janet said. Still, Helen said, if one is going to mix it with spirits, one might at least choose a nice whisky.
And spoil the whisky, Michael queried, helping himself to several spoonfuls of eggs.
It can't be that bad, Helen said. It is, Michael and Janet said in unison. It's true, Janet added. I can't imagine ruining a fine whisky that way. Gin would be a happy medium. Have you even tasted gin? Francesca asked.
It was not, after all, considered a suitable spirit for the upper classes, most especially women.
Once or twice, Janet admitted. And here I thought I knew everything about you, Francesca murmured. I have my secrets, Janet said airily. This is a very odd conversation for the breakfast table, Helen stated. True enough, Janet agreed. She turned to her nephew. Michael, I am most pleased to see you up and about, and looking so fine and healthy.
He inclined his head, thanking her for the compliment. She dabbed the corners of her mouth daintily with her napkin.
But now you must attend to your responsibilities as the Earl, he groaned. Don't be so petulant, Janet said. No one is going to hang you up by your thumbs. All I was going to say is that you must go to the tailor and make sure you have proper evening clothes.
Are you certain I can't donate my thumbs instead?
They're lovely thumbs, Janet replied. But I do believe they'd better serve all of humanity attached to your hands.
Michael met her eyes with a steady stare. Let's see. I have on my schedule today, my first since rising from my sickbed, I might add, a meeting with the Prime Minister concerning my assumption of my seat in Parliament, a meeting with the family solicitor so that I might review the state of our financial holdings, and an interview with our primary estate manager, who I'm told has come down to London with the express purpose of discussing the state of all seven of our family properties. At which point, might I inquire, do you wish me to squeeze in a visit to the tailor? The three ladies were speechless. Perhaps I should inform the Prime Minister that I shall have to move him until Thursday, he asked mildly.
When did you make all of these appointments? Francesca asked, a bit ashamed that she was so surprised at his diligence.
Did you think I'd spent the last fortnight staring at the ceiling?
Well, no, she replied, although in truth she didn't know what she'd thought he'd been doing. Reading, she supposed. That's what she would have done.
When no one said anything further, Michael pushed back his chair. If you ladies will excuse me, he said, setting his napkin down, I believe we have established that I have a busy day ahead of me.
But he'd not even risen from his seat before Janet said quietly, Michael, the tailor?
He froze.
Janet smiled at him sweetly. Tomorrow would be perfectly acceptable.
Francesca rather thought she heard his teeth grind. Janet just tilted her head ever so slightly to the side.
You do need new evening clothes. Surely you would not dream of missing Lady Bridgerton's birthday ball?
Francesca quickly forked a bite of eggs into her mouth so that he wouldn't catch her grinning. Janet was devious in the extreme. Her mother's birthday party was the one event that Michael would feel positively obligated to attend. Anything else he could shrug off without a care. But Violet... Francesca didn't think so. When is it? He sighed.
April 11th, Francesca said sweetly. Everyone will be there.
Everyone, he echoed.
All the Bridgertons.
He brightened visibly.
And everyone else,
she added with a shrug. He looked at her sharply. Define everyone. Her eyes met his.
Everyone.
He slumped in his seat. Am I to get no reprieve?
Of course you are, Helen said. You did, in fact, last week. We called it malaria.
And here I was looking forward to health, he muttered.
Fear not, Janet said. You will have a fine time, I'm sure.
And perhaps meet a lovely lady, Helen put in helpfully. Oh, yes, Michael murmured, lest we forget the real purpose of my life.
It's not such a bad purpose, Francesca said, unable to resist the small chance to tease him.
Oh, really? He asked, swinging his head around to face her. His eyes settled on hers with startling accuracy, leaving Francesca with the extremely unpleasant sensation that perhaps she shouldn't have provoked him.
Really?
She said, since she couldn't back down now. And what are your purposes? He asked sweetly. Out of the corner of her eye, Francesca could see Janet and Helen watching the exchange with avid and unconcealed curiosity.
Oh, this and that, Francesca said with a blithe wave of her hand. Presently, just to finish my breakfast. It is most delicious, wouldn't you agree?
Coddled eggs with a side portion of meddling mothers.
Don't forget your cousin as well, she said, kicking herself under the table as soon as the words left her lips. Everything about his demeanour screamed not to provoke him, but she just couldn't help it. There was little in this world she enjoyed more than provoking Michael Stirling, and moments like this were simply too delicious to resist.
"And how will you be spending your season?" Michael asked, tilting his head slightly into an obnoxiously patient expression.
"I imagine I'll begin by going to my mother's birthday party."
"And what will you be doing there?"
"Offering my felicitations."
"Is that all?"
"Well, I won't be inquiring after her age, if that's what you're asking," Francesca replied. "Oh, no," Janet said, followed by Helen's equally fervent, "Don't do that."
All three ladies turned to Michael with identical, expectant expressions. It was his turn to speak, after all. "I'm leaving," he said, his chair scraping along the floor as he stood. Francesca opened her mouth to say something provoking, since it was always her first inclination to tease him when he was in such a state, but she found herself without words. Michael had changed. It wasn't that he'd been irresponsible before. It was just that he'd been without responsibilities, and it hadn't really occurred to her how well he might rise to the occasion once he returned to England.
"Michael," she said, her soft voice instantly gaining his attention, "good luck with Lord Liverpool."
His eyes caught hers, and something flashed there, a hint of appreciation, maybe of gratitude. Or maybe it was nothing so precise. Maybe it was just a wordless moment of understanding, the sort she'd had with John. Francesca swallowed, uncomfortable with this sudden realization. She reached for her tea with a slow and deliberate movement, as if her control over her body might extend to her mind as well. What had just happened? He was just Michael, wasn't he? Just her friend? Just her long-time confidant? Wasn't that all? Wasn't it?
Chapter 10 Dot, 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 dot.
Nothing more than hatch marks, caused by the tapping of the Countess of Kilmartin's pen against paper, 2 weeks after the receipt of the Earl of Kilmartin's third missive to her.
"Is he here?"
"He's not here."
"Are you certain?"
"I'm quite certain."
"But he is coming."
"He said he was."
"Oh, but when is he coming?"
"I'm sure I don't know."
"You don't?"
"No, I don't."
"Oh, right. Well, oh, look, I see my daughter. Lovely seeing you, Francesca."
Francesca rolled her eyes, not an affectation she espoused, except under the most severe of circumstances, as she watched Mrs. Featherington, one of the Tom's most notorious gossips, toddle off toward her daughter Felicity, who was chatting amiably with a handsome, albeit untitled, young man at the edge of the ballroom. The conversation would have been amusing if it hadn't been the seventh, no, eighth, mustn't forget her own mother, time she had been subjected to it. And the conversation was always the same, truly, down to the very word, save for the fact that not everyone knew her well enough to use her given name. Once Violet Bridgerton had let it be known that the elusive Earl of Kilmartin would be making his reappearance at her birthday party, well, Francesca was quite sure she would never be safe from interrogation again, at least not from anyone with any attachment to an unmarried female. Michael was the catch of the season, and he hadn't even shown up yet.
"Lady Kilmartin?"
She looked up. Lady Danbury was coming her way. A more crotchety and outspoken old lady had never graced the ballrooms of London, but Francesca rather liked her, so she just smiled as the Countess approached, noticing that the partygoers on either side of her quickly fled to parts unknown.
"Lady Danbury," Francesca said, "how nice to see you this evening. Are you enjoying yourself?"
Lady D thumped her cane against the ground for no apparent reason.
"I'd enjoy myself a dashed sight more if someone would tell me how old your mother is."
"I wouldn't dare."
"Pfft, what's the fuss? It's not as if she's as old as I am."
"And how old are you?"
Francesca asked, her tone as sweet as her smile was sly. Lady D's wrinkled face cracked into a smile.
"Clever one you are. Don't think I'm going to tell you."
"Then surely you will understand if I exercise the same loyalty toward my mother."
Lady Danbury grunted, by way of a response, thumping her cane against the floor for emphasis.
"What's the use of a birthday party if no one knows what we're celebrating?"
"The miracle of life and longevity?"
Lady Danbury snorted at that, then asked,
"Where's that new earl of yours?"
"My," she was blunt.
"He's not my earl," Francesca pointed out.
"Well, he's more yours than anyone else's."
That much was probably true, although Francesca wasn't about to confirm it with Lady Danbury, so she just said,
"I imagine his lordship would take exception to being labelled as anyone's but his own."
"His lordship, eh? That's rather formal, don't you think? Thought the two of you were friends."
"We are,"
Francesca said, but that did not mean she would bandy about his given name in public. Truly, it wouldn't do to stir up any rumours, not if she needed to keep her reputation pristine in her search for a husband of her own.
"He was my husband's closest confidant," she said pointedly. "They were like brothers."
Lady Danbury looked disappointed with Francesca's bland characterization of her relationship with Michael, but all she did was pinch her lips as she scanned the crowd.
"This party needs some livening up,"
she muttered, tapping her cane again.
"Do try not to say that to my mother,"
Francesca murmured. Violet had spent weeks on the arrangements, and truly, no one could find exception with the party. The lighting was soft and romantic, the music pure perfection, and even the food was good. No small achievement at a London ball. Francesca had already enjoyed two eclairs, and had spent the time since plotting how to make her way back to the table of refreshments without appearing a complete glutton, except that she kept getting waylaid by inquisitive matrons.
"Oh, it's not your mother's fault," Lady D said. "She's not to blame for the overpopulation of dullards in our society. Good God, she bred eight of you, and not an idiot in the lot."
She gave Francesca a pertinent glance.
"That's a compliment, by the way."
"I'm touched."
Lady Danbury's mouth clamped together into a frighteningly serious line.
"I'm going to have to do something," she said.
"About what?"
"The party."
An awful sensation took hold in Francesca's stomach. She'd never known Lady Danbury to actually ruin someone else's fate, but the old lady was clever enough to do some serious damage if she put her mind to it.
"What exactly do you plan to do?"
Francesca asked, trying to keep her voice free of panic.
"Oh, don't look at me like I'm about to kill your cat."
"I don't have a cat."
"Well, I do, and I assure you I'd be mad as Hades if anyone tried to harm him."
"Lady Danbury, what on earth are you talking about?"
"Oh, I don't know,"
the old lady said with an irritated wave of her hand.
"You can be sure that if I did, I'd have done it already. But I certainly wouldn't cause a scene at your mother's party."
She lifted her chin sharply in the air and gifted Francesca with a disdainful sniff.
"As if I would do anything to hurt your dear mamma's feelings."
Somehow, that did little to assuage Francesca's apprehension.
"Right. Well, whatever you do, please be careful."
"Francesca Stirling,"
Lady Dee said with a sly smile,
"are you worried for my welfare?"
"You, I have no qualms about whatsoever," Francesca replied pertly. "It's the rest of us for whom I tremble."
Lady Danbury let out a cackle of laughter.
"Well said, Lady Kilmartin. I do believe you deserve a reprieve from me,"
she added, in case Francesca didn't grasp her meaning.
"You are my reprieve," Francesca muttered.
But Lady D obviously didn't hear her as she looked out over the crowd, because she sounded quite single-minded as she declared,
"I do believe I shall go pester your brother."
"Which one?"
Not that they all couldn't use a bit of torture.
"That one,"
she pointed toward Colin.
"Hasn't he just returned from Greece?"
"Cyprus, actually."
"Greece, Cyprus, it's all the same to me."
"Not to them, I imagine,"
Francesca murmured.
"Who? You mean the Greeks?"
"Or the Cypriots."
"Pfft. Well, if one of them chooses to show up tonight, they can feel free to explain the difference. Until then, I shall wallow in my ignorance."
And with that, Lady Danbury thumped her cane against the floor one last time before turning toward Colin and bellowing,
"Mr. Bridgerton!"
Francesca watched with amusement as her brother tried desperately to pretend that he hadn't heard her. She was rather pleased that Lady D had chosen to torture Colin a bit. He undoubtedly deserved it. But now that she was on her own again, she realized that Lady Danbury had provided her with a rather effective defense against the multitude of matchmaking mamas who saw her as their only link to Michael. Good God, she could see three of them approaching already. Time to escape. Now. Francesca quickly turned on her heel and started walking toward her sister Eloise, who was easy to spot by the bright green of her dress. In truth, she would have much rather bypassed Eloise entirely and headed straight out the door, but if she was serious about this marriage business, then she had to circulate and let it be known she was in the market for a new husband. Not that anyone was likely to care one way or another, until Michael finally showed his face. Francesca could have announced her plan to move to Dark Africa and take up cannibalism, and all anyone would have said was,
"And will the Earl be accompanying you?" "Good evening," Francesca said, joining the small group around her sister.
It was all family. Eloise was chatting amiably with their two sisters-in-law, Kate and Sophie.
"Oh, hello, Francesca,"
Eloise said.
"Where's..." "Don't you start."
"What's wrong?"
Sophie asked, eyes all concern.
"If one more person asks me about Michael, I swear my head will explode."
"That would certainly change the tenor of the evening,"
Kate remarked.
"Not to mention the cleaning duties of the staff,"
Sophie added. Francesca actually growled.
"Well, where is he?"
Eloise demanded.
"And don't look at me like I'm trying to kill your cat. I don't have a cat. What the devil are you talking about?"
Francesca just sighed.
"I don't know. He said he would be here. If he's smart, he's probably hiding in the hall,"
Sophie said. Good God, you're probably right. Francesca could easily see him bypassing the ballroom entirely and ensconcing himself in the smoking saloon. Away, in other words, from all females.
It's still early, Kate put in helpfully. It doesn't feel early, Francesca grumbled. I wish he'd just get here, so that people would stop asking me about him.
Eloise actually laughed, fiendish turncoat that she was.
Oh, my poor delusional Francesca, she said. Once he arrives, the questions will redouble. They'll simply change from, where is he, to, tell us more.
I fear she's right, Kate said.
Oh, God,
Francesca groaned, looking for a wall to sag against.
Did you just blaspheme?
Sophie asked, blinking in surprise. Francesca sighed.
I seem to be doing quite a bit of it lately.
Sophie gave her a kindly look, then suddenly exclaimed,
You're wearing blue.
Francesca looked down at her new evening gown. She was quite pleased with it, actually. Not that anyone had noticed besides Sophie. It was one of her favourite shades of blue. Not quite royal and not quite marine. The gown was elegantly simple, with a neckline adorned with a softly draped swathe of lighter blue silk. She felt like a princess in it. Or if not a princess, then at the very least, not quite so much the untouchable widow.
Are you out of mourning, then?
Sophie asked.
Well, I've been out of mourning for a few years now, Francesca mumbled.
Now that she had finally shrugged off her greys and lavenders, she felt a little silly for having clung to them for so long.
We knew you were out and about, Sophie said, but you never changed your clothing and, well, it's of no matter. I'm just so pleased to see you in blue.
Does this mean that you will consider remarrying? Kate asked. It has been 4 years.
Francesca winced. Trust Kate to get right to the point. But she couldn't keep her plans a secret forever. Not if she wanted to meet with any success. So all she said was,
Yes.
For a moment, no one spoke. And then, of course, they spoke all at once, offering congratulations and advice and various other bits of nonsense that Francesca wasn't positive she wished to hear. But it was all said with the best and most loving of intentions. So she just smiled and nodded and accepted their good wishes. And then Kate said,
We shall have to set this about, of course.
Francesca was aghast.
I beg your pardon?
The blue dress is an excellent signal of your intentions, Kate explained. But do you really think the men of London are perceptive enough to grasp it?
Of course not, she said, answering her own question before anyone else could.
I could dye Sophie's hair to black, and most of them wouldn't notice a thing.
Well, Benedict would notice,
Sophie pointed out loyally.
Yes, well, he's your husband, and besides that, he's a painter. He's trained to actually notice things. Most men...
Kate cut herself off, looking rather irritated with the turn in the conversation.
You do see my point, don't you?
Of course,
Francesca murmured.
The fact of the matter, Kate continued, is that most of humanity has more hair than wit. If you wish for people to be aware that you are on the marriage mart, you shall have to make it quite clear. Or rather, we shall have to make it clear for you.
Francesca had horrible visions of her female relatives chasing down men until the poor fellows ran screaming for the doors.
What precisely do you mean to do?
Oh, goodness, don't cast up your dinner.
Kate,
Sophie exclaimed.
Well, you must admit that she looked as if she were about to.
Sophie rolled her eyes.
Well, yes, but you needn't have remarked upon it.
I enjoyed the comment.
Eloise put in helpfully. Francesca speared her with a glare, since she was feeling the need to give someone a dirty look, and it was always easiest to do so with one's blood relatives.
We shall be masters of tact and discretion, Kate said. Trust us,
Eloise added.
Well, I certainly can't stop you,
Francesca said. She noticed that even Sophie did not contradict her.
"Very well," she said. "I am off to obtain one last eclair."
"I think they're gone,"
Sophie said, giving her a sympathetic look. Francesca's heart sank.
"The chocolate biscuits?"
"Gone as well."
"What's left?"
"The almond cake. The one that tasted like dust."
"That's the one,"
Eloise put in.
"It was the only dessert Mother didn't sample ahead of time. I warned her, of course, but no one ever listens to me."
Francesca felt herself deflate. Pathetic as she was, the promise of a sweet was the only thing keeping her going just then.
"Cheer up, Franny,"
Eloise said, her chin lifting a notch as she looked out over the crowd.
"I see Michael."
And sure enough, there he was, standing on the other side of the room, looking sinfully elegant in his black evening kit. He was surrounded by women, which didn't surprise Francesca in the least. Half were the sorts who were pursuing him for marriage, either for themselves or their daughters. The other half, Francesca noted, were young and married, and clearly pursuing him for something else entirely.
"I'd forgotten how handsome he was," Kate murmured.
Francesca glared at her.
"He's very tanned,"
Sophie added.
"He was in India,"
Francesca said.
"Of course he's tanned. You're rather short of temper this evening,"
Eloise said. Francesca schooled her features into an impassive mask.
"I'm just weary of being asked about him, that's all. He's not my favourite topic of conversation." "Did the two of you have a falling out?"
Sophie inquired.
"No, of course not,"
Francesca replied, realising belatedly that she'd given the wrong impression.
"But I have done nothing but speak of him all evening. At this point, I would be quite delighted to comment on the weather."
Yes.
Right, of course."
Francesca had no idea who'd said what, especially when she realised that all four of them were just standing there, staring at Michael and his bevy of women.
"He is handsome,"
Sophie sighed.
"All that delicious black hair."
"Sophie!"
Francesca exclaimed.
"Well, he is,"
Sophie said defensively.
"And you didn't say anything to Kate when she made the same comment."
"You're both married,"
Francesca muttered.
"Does that mean I might comment upon his good looks?"
Eloise asked.
"Spinster that I am."
Francesca turned to her sister in disbelief.
"Michael is the last man you'd want to marry."
"Why is that?"
This came from Sophie, but Francesca noticed that Eloise was listening closely for her answer as well.
"Because he's a terrible rake,"
Francesca said.
"Funny,"
Eloise murmured.
"You flew quite off the handle when Hyacinth said the same thing a fortnight ago."
Trust Eloise to remember everything.
"Hyacinth didn't know what she was talking about,"
Francesca said.
"She never does. And besides, we were talking about his punctuality, not his marriageability."
"And what renders him so unmarriageable?"
Eloise asked. Francesca levelled a serious stare at her older sister. Eloise was mad if she thought she should set her cap for Michael.
"Well?"
Eloise prodded.
"He could never remain faithful to one woman,"
Francesca said.
"And I doubt you'd be willing to put up with infidelities."
"No,"
Eloise murmured.
"Not unless he'd be willing to put up with severe bodily injury."
The four ladies fell silent at that, continuing their shameless perusal of Michael and his companions. He leaned down and murmured something in one of their ears, causing the lady in question to titter and blush, hiding her mouth behind her hand.
"He's quite a flirt," Kate said.
"A certain air about him,"
Sophie confirmed.
"Those women haven't a chance."
He smiled at one of his companions. Then a slow, liquid grin that caused even the Bridgerton women to sigh.
"Haven't we something better to do besides spy on Michael?"
Francesca asked, disgusted. Kate, Sophie, and Eloise looked at each other, blinking.
"No."
"No."
"I guess not," Kate concluded.
"Not just now, anyway."
"You should go and talk to him,"
Eloise said, nudging Francesca with her elbow.
Why on earth?
Because he's here.
So are 100 other men,
Francesca replied,
all of whom I'd rather marry. I only see 3 I'd even consider promising to obey,
Eloise muttered,
and I'm not even certain about them.
Be that as it may,
Francesca said, not wanting to grant Eloise the point.
My purpose here is to find a husband, so I hardly see how dancing attendance on Michael will be of any benefit. And I thought we were here to wish Mother a happy birthday,
Eloise murmured. Francesca glared at her. She and Eloise were the closest of all the Bridgertons in age, exactly 1 year apart. Francesca would have given her life for Eloise, of course, and there was certainly no other woman who knew more of her secrets and inner thoughts, but half the time she could have happily strangled her sister, including right now, especially right now.
Eloise is right,
Sophie said to Francesca.
You should go over and greet Michael. It's only polite, considering his long stay abroad. It's not as if we haven't been living in the same house for over a week,
Francesca said.
We've more than said our greetings. Yes, but not in public,
Sophie replied.
And not at your family's home. If you don't go over and speak with him, everyone will comment upon it tomorrow. They will think there is a rift between the two of you, or worse, that you do not accept him as the new Earl.
Of course I accept him, Francesca said.
And even if I didn't, what would it matter? The line of succession was hardly in doubt.
You need to show everyone that you hold him in high esteem,
Sophie said. Then she turned to Francesca with a quizzical expression.
Unless, of course, you don't.
No, of course I do,
Francesca said with a sigh. Sophie was right. Sophie was always right when it came to matters of propriety. She should go and greet Michael. He deserved an official and public welcome to London, as ludicrous as it seemed, given that she had spent the last few weeks nursing him through his malarial fevers. She just didn't relish fighting her way through his throng of admirers. She'd always found Michael's reputation amusing, probably because she felt rather removed from it all, above it even. It had been a bit of an inside joke between the three of them, her, John, and Michael. He'd never taken any of the women seriously, and so she hadn't either. But now she wasn't watching from her comfortable, secure position as a happily married lady, and Michael was no longer just the merry rake, a ne'er-do-well who maintained his position in society through wit and charm. He was an earl, and she was a widow, and she suddenly felt rather small and powerless. It wasn't his fault, of course. She knew that, just as she knew that he'd make someone a terrible husband some day. But somehow she couldn't quite block her ire, if not with him, then with the gaggle of giggling females around him.
Francesca,
Sophie asked,
do you want one of us to go with you?
What?
No, of course not.
Francesca drew herself up straight, embarrassed to have been caught wool-gathering by her sisters.
I can see to Michael,
she said firmly. She took 2 steps in his direction, then turned back to Kate, Sophie, and Eloise.
After I see to myself, she said.
And with that, she turned to make her way to the ladies' retiring room. If she was going to have to smile and be polite amidst Michael's simpering women, she might as well do it without feeling she had to hop from foot to foot. But as she departed, she heard Eloise's low murmur of,
Coward?
It took all of Francesca's fortitude not to turn around and impale her sister with a scathing retort. Well, that, and the fact that she rather feared Eloise was right. And it was mortifying to think that she might have turned coward over Michael, of all people. Chapter 11
I have heard from Michael. 3 times, actually. I have not yet responded. You would be disappointed in me, I'm sure.
But I...
From the Countess of Kilmartin to her deceased husband, 10 months after Michael's departure for India, crumpled with a muttered,
"This is madness,"
and tossed in the fire. Michael had spotted Francesca the moment he'd entered the ballroom. She was standing at the far side of the room, chatting with her sisters, wearing a blue gown and new hairstyle. And he noticed the instant she left as well, exiting through the door in the northwest wall, presumably to go to the ladies' retiring room, which he knew was just down the hall. Worst of all, he was quite certain he would be equally aware of her return, even though he was conversing with about a dozen other ladies, all of whom thought he was giving their little gathering his full attention. It was like a sickness with him, a sixth sense. He couldn't be in a room with Francesca and not know where she was. It had been like this since the moment they'd met, and the only thing that made it bearable was that she hadn't a clue. It was one of the things he had most enjoyed about India. She wasn't there. He never had to be aware of her. But she'd haunted him still. Every now and then he'd catch a glimpse of chestnut hair that caught the candlelight as hers did, or someone would laugh, and for a split second it sounded like hers. His breath would catch, and he would look for her, even though he knew she wasn't there. It was hell, and usually worthy of a stiff drink, or a night spent with his latest paramour, or both. But that was over, and now he was back in London, and he was surprised by how easy it was to fall into his old role as the devil-may-care charmer. Nothing much had changed in town. Oh, some of the faces were different, but the aggregate sum of the ton was the same. Lady Bridgerton's birthday fete was much as he had anticipated, although he had to admit that he was a little taken aback at the level of curiosity aroused by his reappearance in London. It seemed the merry rake had become the dashing earl, and within the first 15 minutes of his arrival, he had been accosted by no fewer than 9, mustn't forget Lady Bridgerton herself, society matrons all eager to court his favour, and, of course, introduce him to their lovely and unattached daughters. He wasn't quite sure if it was amusing or hell. Amusing, he decided, for now at least. By next week, he had no doubt it would be hell. After another 15 minutes of introductions, re-introductions, and only slightly veiled propositions, thankfully by a widow, and not one of the debutantes or their mothers, he announced his intention to locate his hostess and excused himself from the crowd. And then there she was, Francesca. Halfway across the room, of course, which meant that he'd have to make his way through the punishing crowd if he wanted to speak with her. She looked breathtakingly lovely, in a deep blue gown, and he realised that for all her talk about buying herself a new wardrobe, this was the first he'd seen her out of her half-mourning colours. Then it hit him again. She was finally out of mourning. She would remarry. She would laugh and flirt and wear blue and find a husband. And it would probably all happen in the space of a month. Once she made clear her intention to remarry, the men would be beating down her door. How could anyone not want to marry her? She might not have been as youthful as the other women looking for husbands, but she had something the younger debutantes lacked. A sparkle, a vivacity, a gleam of intelligence in her eyes that brought something extra to her beauty. She was still alone, standing in the doorway. Amazingly, no one else seemed to have noticed her entrance, so Michael decided to brave the crowds and make his way to her. But she saw him first, and although she did not exactly smile, her lips curved and her eyes flashed with recognition, and as she walked to him, his breath caught. It shouldn't have surprised him, and yet it did. Every time he thought he knew everything about her, had unwillingly memorised every last detail, something inside her flickered and changed, and he felt himself falling anew. He would never escape her, this woman, He would never escape her, and he could never have her. Even with John gone, it was impossible. Quite simply wrong. There was too much there. Too much had happened, and he would never be able to shake the feeling that he had somehow stolen her. Or worse, that he had wished for this, that he had wanted John gone and out of the way, wanted the title and Francesca and everything else. He closed the distance between them, meeting her halfway.
"Francesca," he murmured, making his voice smooth and personable, "it is a delight to see you."
"And you as well," she replied. She smiled then, but it was in an amused sort of fashion, and he had the unexpected sense that she was mocking him. But there seemed little to be gained by pointing this out. It would only demonstrate how attuned he was to her every expression. And so he just said,
"Have you been enjoying yourself?"
"Of course. Have you?"
"Of course." She quirked a brow.
"Even in your present state of solitude?"
"I beg your pardon?"
She shrugged carelessly.
"The last I saw of you, you were surrounded by women."
"If you saw me, why didn't you come over to save me?"
"Save you?" she said with a laugh. "Anyone could see that you were enjoying yourself."
"Is that so?"
"Oh, please, Michael,"
she said, giving him a pointed glance.
"You live to flirt and seduce."
"In that order,"
she shrugged.
"You're not the merry rake for nothing."
He felt his jaw clamping together. Her comment rankled, and then the fact that it did rankled some more. She studied his face, closely enough to make him want to squirm with discomfort, and then her own erupted into a smile.
"You don't like it,"
she said slowly, almost breathless with the realization.
"Oh, my heavens, you don't like it."
She looked as if she'd just experienced an epiphany of biblical proportions. But as the whole thing was at his expense, all he could do was scowl. Then she laughed, which made it even worse.
"My,"
she said, actually holding her hand to her belly in mirth.
"You feel like a fox at a hunt, and you don't like it one bit. Oh, this is simply too much, after all the women you've chased."
She had it all wrong, of course. He didn't much care, one way or another, that the society matrons had labelled him the season's biggest catch and were pursuing him accordingly. That was just the sort of thing it was easy to maintain a sense of humour over. He didn't care if they called him the merry rake. He didn't care if they thought him a worthless seducer. But when Francesca said the same thing, it was like acid. And the worst of it was, he had no one to blame but himself. He had cultivated this reputation for years, spent countless hours teasing and flirting, and then making sure Francesca saw so she would never guess the truth. And maybe he had done it for himself too, because if he was the merry rake, at least he was something. The alternative was to be nothing but a pathetic fool, hopelessly in love with another man's wife. And hell, he was good at being the man who could seduce with a smile. He might as well have something in life he could succeed at.
"You can't say I didn't warn you,"
Francesca said, sounding very pleased with herself.
"It's not so bad surrounding oneself with beautiful women," he said, mostly to irritate her. "Even better when it comes about so effortlessly."
It worked, because her face pinched just a bit around the mouth.
"I'm sure it's more than delightful, but you must be careful not to forget yourself," she said sharply. "These are not your usual women."
"I wasn't aware I had usual women."
"You know exactly what I mean, Michael. Others may have called you a complete rogue, but I know you better than that."
"Oh, really?"
And he almost laughed. She thought she knew him so well, but she knew nothing. She'd never know the full truth.
"You had standards 4 years ago," she continued. "You never seduced anyone who would be irreparably hurt by your actions."
"And what makes you think I'm about to start now?"
"Oh, I don't think you'd do anything like that on purpose," she said. "But before, you never even associated with young women looking for marriage. There wasn't even the possibility that you might make a misstep and accidentally ruin one of them."
The vague, prickling sense of irritation that had been simmering within him began to grow and boil. "Who do you think I am, Francesca?" he asked, his entire body stiff with something he couldn't quite put his finger on. He hated that she thought this of him. Hated it.
"Michael,
do you really think me so dim that I might accidentally ruin a young lady's reputation?" Her lips parted, then quivered slightly before she replied.
"Not dim, Michael, of course not, but..."
"Careless, then," he bit off.
"No, not that either. I just think..."
"What, Francesca?" he asked ruthlessly. "What do you think of me?"
"I think you are one of the finest men I know," she said softly.
Damn! Trust her to unman him with a single sentence. He stared at her, just stared at her, trying to figure out what the hell she'd meant by that.
"I do," she said with a shrug. "But I also think you're foolish, and I think you can be fickle, and I think you're going to break more hearts this spring than I'll be able to count."
"It isn't your job to count them," he said, his voice quiet and hard.
"No, it isn't, is it?"
She looked over at him and smiled wryly.
"But I'm going to end up doing it all the same, won't I?"
"And why is that?" She didn't seem to have an answer to that. And then, just when he was sure she would say no more, she whispered,
"Because I won't be able to stop myself."
Several seconds passed. They just stood there, their backs to the wall, looking for all the world as if they were just watching the party. Finally, Francesca broke the silence and said,
"You should dance."
He turned to her. "With you?"
"Yes, once at least. But you should also dance with someone eligible. Someone you might marry."
Someone he might marry. Anyone but her.
"It will signal to society that you're at least open to the possibility of matrimony," Francesca added.
When he made no comment, she asked,
"Aren't you?"
"Open to matrimony?"
"Yes."
"If you say so," he said, somewhat flippantly. He had to be cavalier. It was the only way he could mask the bitterness sweeping over him.
"Felicity Featherington,"
Francesca said, motioning toward a very pretty young lady about 10 yards away.
"She'd be an excellent choice. Very sensible. She won't fall in love with you."
He looked down at her sardonically. "Heaven forbid I find love." Francesca's lips parted, and her eyes grew very wide.
"Is that what you want?" she asked. "To find love?"
She looked delighted by the prospect, delighted that he might find the perfect woman. And there it was, his faith in a higher power reaffirmed. Truly, moments of this ironic perfection could not come about by accident.
"Michael?"
Francesca asked. Her eyes were bright and shining, and she clearly wanted something for him, something wonderful and good. And all he wanted was to scream. "I have no idea," he said caustically. "Not a single bloody clue."
"Michael,"
she looked stricken, but for once he didn't care. "If you will excuse me," he said sharply, "I believe I have a Featherington to dance with."
"Michael, what is wrong?" she asked. "What did I say?"
"Nothing," he said. "Nothing at all."
"Don't be this way."
As he turned to her, he felt something wash over him, a numbness that somehow slid a mask back over his face, enabled him to smile smoothly and regard her with his legendary, heavy-lidded stare. He was once again the rake, maybe not so merry, but every bit the urbane seducer. "What way?" he asked, his lips twisting with a perfect mix of innocence and condescension. I'm doing exactly what you asked of me. Dance with the Featherington, didn't you say? I'm following your instructions to the letter.
You're angry with me,
she whispered. Of course not, he said, but they both knew his voice was too easy, too suave. I've merely accepted that you, Francesca, know best. Here I've been listening to my own mind and conscience all this time, but to what avail? Heaven knows where I'd be if I'd listened to you years ago. Her breath gasped across her lips, and she drew back.
I need to go,
she said. Go then, he said. Her chin lifted a notch.
There are many men here.
Very many.
I need to find a husband.
You should, he agreed. Her lips pressed together, and then she added,
I might find one tonight.
He almost gave her a mocking smile. She always had to have the last word. You might, he said, at the very second he knew she thought the conversation had concluded. By then, she was just far enough away that she couldn't yell back one last retort. But he saw the way she paused and tensed her shoulders, and he knew she'd heard him. He leaned back against the wall and smiled. One had to take one's simple pleasures where one could. The next day, Francesca felt perfectly horrid. And worse, she couldn't quell an extremely annoying quiver of guilt, even though Michael was the one who'd spoken so insultingly the night before. Truly, what had she said to provoke such an unkind reaction on his part? And what right did he have to act so badly toward her? All she had done was express a bit of joy that he might want to find a true and loving marriage, rather than spend his days in shallow debauchery. But apparently she'd been wrong. Michael had spent the entire night, both before and after their conversation, charming every woman at the party. It had gotten to the point where she had thought she might be ill. But the worst of it was, she couldn't seem to stop herself from counting his conquests, just as she'd predicted the night before. 1, 2, 3, she'd murmured, watching him enchant a trio of sisters with his smile. 4, 5, 6. There went 2 widows and a countess. It was disgusting, and Francesca was disgusted with herself for having been so mesmerized. And then, every now and then, he'd look at her, just look at her, with a heavy-lidded, mocking stare, and she couldn't help but think that he knew what she was doing, that he was moving from woman to woman just so that she could round her count up to the next dozen or so. Why had she said that? What had she been thinking? Or had she been thinking not at all? It seemed the only explanation. She certainly hadn't intended to tell him that she wouldn't be able to stop herself from tallying his broken hearts. The words had whispered over her lips before she'd even realized she was thinking them. And even now, she wasn't sure what it meant. Why did she care? Why on earth did she care how many ladies fell under his spell? She'd never cared before. It was only going to get worse, too. The women were mad for Michael. If the rules of society were reversed, Francesca thought wryly, their drawing room at Kilmartin House would be overflowing with flowers, all addressed to the dashing Earl. It was still going to be dreadful. She would be inundated with visitors today. Of that she was certain. Every woman in London would call upon her in hopes that Michael might stroll through the drawing room. Francesca was going to have to endure countless questions, occasional innuendo and...
Good heavens!
She stopped short, peering into the drawing room with dubious eyes.
What is all this?
Flowers. Everywhere. It was her nightmare come true. Had someone changed the rules of society and forgotten to tell her? Violets, irises and daisies, imported tulips, hothouse orchids and roses. Roses everywhere, of every colour. The smell was almost overwhelming.
Priestley,
Francesca called out, spying her butler across the room, setting a tall vase of snapdragons on a table.
"What are all these flowers?"
He gave the vase one last adjustment, twisting one pink stalk so that it faced away from the wall, then turned and walked toward her.
"They are for you, my lady."
She blinked.
"Me?"
"Indeed. Would you care to read the cards? I have left them on the arrangements so that you would be able to identify each sender."
"Oh."
It seemed all she could say. She felt rather like a simpleton, with her hand over her opened mouth, glancing back and forth at all the flowers.
"If you'd like," Priestley continued, "I could remove each card and note on the back which arrangement I took it from. Then you could read through them all at once."
When Francesca didn't reply, he suggested,
"Perhaps you would like to remove yourself to your desk? I would be happy to bring you the cards."
"No, no,"
she said, still feeling terribly distracted by all this. She was a widow, for heaven's sake. Men weren't supposed to bring her flowers, were they?
"My lady?"
I...
She turned to Priestley, straightening her spine as she forced her mind back to clarity. Or tried.
"I will just have a look at..."
She turned to the nearest bouquet. A lovely and delicate arrangement of grape hyacinths and stephanotis.
"A pale comparison to your eyes,"
the card read. It was signed by the Marquess of Chester. Francesca gasped. Lord Chester's wife had died 2 years earlier. Everyone knew he was looking for a new bride. Barely able to contain the oddly giddy feeling rising within her, she inched down toward an arrangement of roses and picked up the card, trying very hard not to appear too eager in front of the butler.
"I wonder who this is from,"
she said with studied casualness. "A sonnet. From Shakespeare, if she remembered correctly. Signed by Viscount Trevelstom." Trevelstom? They'd only been introduced but once. He was young, very handsome, and it was rumoured that his father had squandered away most of the family fortune. The new Viscount would have to marry someone wealthy, or so everyone said.
"Good heavens!"
Francesca turned to see Janet behind her.
"What is this?"
she asked.
"I do believe those were my exact words upon entering the room,"
Francesca murmured. She handed Janet the two cards, then watched her carefully as her eyes scanned the neatly handwritten lines. Janet had lost her only child when John had died. How would she react to Francesca being wooed by other men?
"My goodness," Janet said, looking up. "You seem to be this season's incomparable." "Oh, don't be silly,"
Francesca said, blushing. Blushing? Good God, what was wrong with her? She didn't blush. She hadn't even blushed during her first season, when she really had been an incomparable.
"I'm far too old for that," she mumbled.
"Apparently not," Janet said.
"There are more in the hall," Priestley said.
Janet turned to Francesca.
"Have you looked through all the cards?"
"Not yet, but I imagine that they're more of the same." Francesca nodded.
"Does that bother you?"
Janet smiled sadly, but her eyes were kind and wise.
"Do I wish you were still married to my son?"
"Of course."
"Do I want you to spend the rest of your life married to his memory?"
"Of course not." She reached out and clasped one of Francesca's hands in her own.
"You are a daughter to me, Francesca. I want you to be happy."
"I would never dishonour John's memory," Francesca assured her.
"Of course not. If you were the sort who would, he'd never have married you in the first place.
Or," she added with a sly look, "I would never have allowed him to."
"I would like children,"
Francesca said. Somehow she felt the need to explain it, to make sure that Janet understood that what she truly wanted was to be a mother, not necessarily a wife. Janet nodded, turning away as she dabbed at her eyes with her fingertips.
"We should read the rest of these cards,"
she said, her brisk tone signalling that she'd like to move on, and perhaps prepare ourselves for an onslaught of afternoon calls. Francesca followed her as she sought out an enormous display of tulips and plucked the card free.
"I rather think the callers will be women," Francesca said, "inquiring after Michael."
"You may be right," Janet replied. She held the card up.
"May I?" "Of course."
Janet scanned the words, then looked up and said,
"Cheshire."
Francesca gasped.
"As in the Duke of?"
"The very one." Francesca actually placed her hand over her heart.
"My word," she breathed. "The Duke of Cheshire."
"You, my dear, are clearly the catch of the season."
"But I..."
"What the devil is this?"
It was Michael, catching a vase he'd nearly overturned and looking extremely cross and put out.
"Good morning, Michael,"
Janet said cheerfully. He nodded at her, then turned to Francesca and grumbled,
"You look as if you're about to pledge allegiance to your sovereign lord."
"And that would be you, I imagine?"
she shot back, quickly dropping her hand to her side. She hadn't even realised it was still over her heart.
"If you're lucky," he muttered.
Francesca just gave him a look. He smirked right back in return.
"And are we opening a flower shop?"
"No, but clearly we could," Janet replied. "Therefore Francesca,"
she added helpfully.
"Of course, therefore Francesca," he muttered. "Although, good God, I don't know who would be idiot enough to send roses."
"I like roses," Francesca said.
"Everyone sends roses," he said dismissively. "They're trite and old and..."
He motioned to Trevelstam's yellow ones.
"Who sent this?"
"Trevelstam," Janet answered.
Michael let out a snort and swung around to face Francesca.
"You're not going to marry him, are you?"
"Probably not. But I fail to see what..."
"He hasn't 2 shillings to rub together," he stated.
"How would you know?"
Francesca asked.
"You haven't even been back a month."
Michael shrugged.
"I've been to my club."
"Well, it may be true, but it is hardly his fault,"
Francesca felt compelled to point out. Not that she felt any great loyalty to Lord Trevelstam, but still, she did try to be fair, and it was common knowledge that the young Viscount had spent the last year trying to repair the damage his profligate father had done to the family fortunes.
"You're not marrying him, and that's final,"
Michael announced. She should have been annoyed by his arrogance, but the truth was, she was mostly just amused.
"Very well," she said, lips twitching. "I'll select someone else."
"Good,"
he grunted.
"She has many to choose from," Janet put in.
"Indeed,"
Michael said caustically.
"I'm going to have to find Helen," Janet said. "She won't want to miss this."
"I hardly think the flowers are going to fly out the window before she rises," Michael said.
"Of course not,"
Janet replied sweetly, giving him a motherly pat on the arm. Francesca quickly swallowed a laugh. Michael would hate that, and Janet knew it.
"She does adore her flowers, though," Janet said. "May I take one of the arrangements up to her?"
"Of course," Francesca replied. Janet reached for Trevelstam's roses, then stopped herself.
"Oh, no, I had better not," she said, turning back around to face Michael and Francesca. "He might stop by, and we wouldn't want him to think we'd banished his flowers to some far corner of the house."
"Oh, right," Francesca murmured. "Of course." Michael just grunted.
"Nevertheless, I'd better go tell her about this," Janet said,
and she turned and hurried up the stairs. Michael sneezed, then glared at a particularly innocuous display of gladiolas.
"We're going to have to open a window," he grumbled.
"And freeze."
"I'll wear a coat," he ground out.
Francesca smiled. She wanted to grin.
"Are you jealous?"
she asked coyly. He swung around and nearly levelled her with a dumbstruck expression.
"Not over me,"
she said quickly, almost blushing at the thought.
My word, not that.
Then what? He asked, his voice quiet and clipped.
Well, just... I mean...
She motioned to the flowers, a clear display of her sudden popularity.
Well, we're both after much the same goal this season, aren't we?
He just stared at her blankly.
Marriage,
she said. Good heavens, he was particularly obtuse this morning. Your point. She let out an impatient breath.
I don't know if you had thought about it, but I'd naturally assumed you would be the one to be relentlessly pursued. I never dreamed that I would, well...
emerge as a prize to be won. It wasn't the nicest way of putting it, but it wasn't exactly inaccurate. So she just said,
well, yes, I suppose.
For a moment he said nothing, but he was watching her strangely, almost wryly. And then he said, his voice quiet, a man would have to be a fool not to want to marry you. Francesca felt her mouth form a surprised oval.
Oh,
she said, quite at a loss for words.
That's quite the nicest thing you could have said to me just now.
He sighed and ran his hand through his hair. She decided not to tell him that he'd just deposited a streak of yellow pollen into the black strands. Francesca, he said, looking tired and weary, and something else. Regretful? No, that was impossible. Michael wasn't the sort to regret anything. I would never begrudge you this. You, he cleared his throat, you should be happy.
I...
It was the strangest moment, especially after their tense words the night before. She hadn't the faintest clue how to reply, and so she just changed the subject and said,
your turn will come.
He looked at her quizzically.
It already has, really, she continued. Last night, I was besieged with far more admirers for your hand than for my own. If women could send flowers, we'd be completely awash with them.
He smiled, but the sentiment didn't quite reach his eyes. He didn't look angry, just hollow. And she was struck by what a strange observation that was.
Last night, he said, reaching up and tugging at his cravat. If I said anything to upset you...
She watched his face. It was so dear to her, and she knew every last detail of it. 4 years, it seemed, did little to smudge a memory. But something was different now. He'd changed, but she wasn't sure how. And she wasn't sure why.
Everything is fine, she assured him.
Nonetheless, he said gruffly, I'm sorry.
But for the rest of the day, Francesca wondered if he knew exactly what he was apologizing for. And she couldn't escape the feeling that she wasn't sure either.
Chapter 12.
Rather ridiculous writing to you, but I suppose after so many months in the East, my perspective on death and the afterlife has slid into something that would have sent Vicar MacLeish screaming for the hills. So far from England, it is almost possible to pretend that you are still alive and able to receive this note, just like the many I sent from France. But then someone calls out to me, and I am reminded that I am Kilmartin, and you are in a place unreachable by the Royal Mail. From the Earl of Kilmartin to his deceased cousin, the previous Earl, 1 year and 2 months after his departure for India, written to completion, and then burned slowly over a candle. It wasn't that he enjoyed feeling like an ass, Michael reflected, as he swirled a glass of brandy at his club, but it seemed that lately, around Francesca at least, he couldn't quite avoid acting like one. There she had been at her mother's birthday party, so damned happy for him, so delighted that he had uttered the word love in her presence, and he had simply snapped, because he knew how her mind worked,
and he knew that she was already thinking madly ahead, trying to select the perfect woman for him. And the truth was, well, the truth was just too pathetic for words. But he'd apologized, and although he could swear up and down that he wasn't going to behave like an idiot again, he would probably find himself apologizing again sometime in the future, and she would most likely just chalk it all up to a cranky nature on his part. Never mind that he'd been a model of good humour and equanimity when John had been alive. He downed his brandy. Bugger it all. Well, he'd be done with this nonsense soon. She'd find someone, marry the bloke, and move out of the house. They would remain friends, of course. Francesca wasn't the sort to allow otherwise. But he wouldn't see her every day over the breakfast table. He wouldn't even see her as often as he had before John's death. Her new husband would not permit her to spend so much time in his company, cousinly relationship or no.
"Sterling!"
he heard someone call out, followed by the usual slight cough which preceded,
"Kilmartin, I mean. So sorry."
Michael looked up to see Sir Geoffrey Fowler, an acquaintance of his from his days at Cambridge.
"Nothing of it,"
he said, motioning to the chair across from him.
"Splendid to see you,"
Sir Geoffrey said, taking a seat. "I trust your journey home was uneventful." The pair exchanged the most basic of pleasantries until Sir Geoffrey got to the point.
"I understand that Lady Kilmartin is looking for a husband," he said.
Michael felt as if he'd been punched. Never mind the atrocious floral display in his drawing room. It still sounded rather distasteful coming from someone's lips. Someone young, reasonably handsome, and obviously in the market for a wife.
Yes, he finally replied. "I believe she is."
"Excellent."
Sir Geoffrey rubbed his hands together in anticipation, leaving Michael with the overwhelming desire to smack his face.
"She will be quite choosy,"
Michael said peevishly. Sir Geoffrey didn't seem to care.
"Will you dower her?"
"What?"
Michael snapped. Good God, he was now her nearest male relative, wasn't he? He'd probably have to give her away at her wedding. Hell.
"Will you?"
Sir Geoffrey persisted.
"Of course," Michael bit off.
Sir Geoffrey sucked in his breath appreciatively.
"Her brother offered to do so as well."
"The Sterlings will care for her,"
Michael said stiffly. Sir Geoffrey shrugged.
"It appears the Bridgertons will as well."
Michael felt his teeth grinding to powder.
"Don't look so dyspeptic," Sir Geoffrey said. "With a double dowry, she'll be off your hands in no time. I'm sure you're eager to be rid of her."
Michael cocked his head, trying to decide which side of Sir Geoffrey's nose could better take a punch.
"She's got to be a burden on you,"
Sir Geoffrey continued blithely.
"The clothes alone must cost a fortune."
Michael wondered what the legal ramifications were for strangling a knight of the realm. Surely nothing he couldn't live with.
"And then, when you marry,"
Sir Geoffrey continued, obviously unaware that Michael was flexing his fingers and measuring his neck,
"your new countess won't want her in the house. Can't have two hens in charge of the household, right?"
"Right,"
Michael said tightly.
"Very well, then," Sir Geoffrey said, standing up. "Good to speak with you, Kilmartin. I must be off. Need to go tell Shively the news. Not that I want the competition, of course, but this isn't likely to stay a secret for very long anyway. I might as well be the one to let it out."
Michael frosted him with a glare, but Sir Geoffrey was too excited with his gossip to notice. Michael looked down at his glass. Right. He'd drunk it all. Damn. He signalled to a waiter to bring him another, then sat back, with every intention of reading the newspaper he'd picked up on the way in. But before he could even scan the headlines, he heard his name yet again. He made the minimum effort required to hide his irritation and looked up. Trevelstam. Of the Yellow Roses. Michael felt the newspaper crumple between his fingers.
"Kilmartin,"
the Viscount said. Michael nodded. Trevelstom. They knew each other, not closely, but well enough so that a friendly conversation was not unexpected.
"Have a seat," he said, motioning to the chair across from him.
Trevelstom sat, setting his half-sipped drink on the table.
"How do you fare?" he asked. "Haven't seen you much since your return."
"Well enough," Michael grunted.
Considering that he was being forced to sit with some ninny who wanted to marry Francesca's dowry. No, make that her double dowry. The way gossip spread, Trevelstom had probably already heard the news from Sir Geoffrey. Trevelstom was slightly more sophisticated than Sir Geoffrey. He managed to make small talk for a full 3 minutes, asking about Michael's trip to India, the voyage back, etc., etc., etc. But then, of course, he got down to his true purpose.
"I called upon Lady Kilmartin this afternoon," he said.
"Did you?" Michael murmured. He hadn't returned home since leaving that morning. The last thing he had wanted was to be present for Francesca's parade of suitors.
"Indeed, she's a lovely woman."
"That she is," Michael said, glad his drink had arrived. Then not so glad when he realized it had arrived 2 minutes earlier and he had already drunk it. Trevelstom cleared his throat.
"I'm sure you are aware that I intend to court her."
"I'm certainly aware of it now."
Michael eyed his glass, trying to determine if there might be a few drops of brandy left after all.
"I wasn't certain whether I should inform you or her brother of my intentions."
Michael was quite certain that Anthony Bridgerton, Francesca's eldest brother, was quite capable of weeding out unsuitable marriage prospects. But nonetheless, he said,
"I am quite sufficient."
"Good, good," Trevelstom murmured, taking another sip of his drink.
"Trevelstom!" came a booming voice. "And Kilmartin, too."
It was Lord Hardwick, big and beefy, and if not yet drunk, not exactly sober either.
"Hardwick," both men said, acknowledging his arrival.
Hardwick grabbed a chair, scraping it along the floor until it found a place at the table.
"Good to see you, good to see you," he huffed. "Capital night, don't you think? Most excellent indeed."
Michael had no idea what he was talking about, but he nodded anyway. Better that than actually to ask him what he meant. Michael was quite certain he lacked the patience to listen to an explanation.
"Thistlethwaite's over there setting bets on the Queen's dogs. And, heard about Lady Kilmartin, too. Good talk tonight," he said, nodding approvingly. "Good talk indeed. Hate when it's quiet here."
"And how are the Queen's dogs faring?" Michael inquired.
"Out of mourning, I understand."
"The dogs?"
"No, Lady Kilmartin," Hardwick chortled. "Good one there, Kilmartin."
Michael signalled for another drink. He was going to need it.
"Wore blue the other night, she did,"
Hardwick said.
"Everyone saw."
"She looked quite lovely," Trevelstom added.
"Indeed, indeed," Hardwick said. "Good woman. I'd go after her myself if I weren't already shackled to Lady Hardwick."
Small favours and all that, Michael decided.
"She mourned the old Earl for how long?"
Hardwick asked.
6 years.
As the old Earl had been but 28 at the time of his death, Michael found the comment somewhat offensive. But there seemed little point in attempting to change Lord Hardwick's customary bad judgment and behaviour at this late stage in his life. And from the size and ruddiness of him, he was clearly going to keel over at any time. Right now, in fact, if Michael was lucky. He glanced across the table. Still alive. Damn.
4 years, he said succinctly. "My cousin died 4 years ago."
4, 6, whatever,
Hardwick said with a shrug.
"It's still a bloody long time to black the windows."
I believe she was in half mourning for some time, Trevelstan put in.
Eh?
Really? Hardwick took a swig of his drink, then wiped his mouth rather sloppily with a handkerchief.
All the same for the rest of us, when you think about it. She wasn't looking for a husband till now.
No, Michael said, mostly because Hardwick had actually stopped talking for a few seconds.
The men are going to be after her like bees to honey,
Hardwick predicted, drawing out the bees until it sounded like it ended with four Zs.
Bees to honey, I tell you. Everyone knows she was devoted to the old Earl. Everyone.
Michael's drink arrived. Thank God.
And there's been no whiff of scandal attached to her name since he died,
Hardwick added.
I should say not, Trevelstan said.
Not like some of the widows out and about,
Hardwick continued, taking another swig of his liquor. He chuckled lewdly and elbowed Michael.
If you know what I mean.
Michael just drank.
It's like...
Hardwick leaned in, his jowls jiggling as his expression grew salacious.
It's like...
For God's sake, man, just spit it out, Michael muttered.
Eh?
Hardwick said. Michael just scowled.
I'll tell you what it's like,
Hardwick said with a leer.
It's like you're getting a virgin who knows what to do.
Michael stared at him.
What did you just say?
He asked very quietly.
I said...
I'd take care not to repeat that if I were you,
Trevelstan quickly interjected, casting an apprehensive glance at Michael's darkening visage.
Eh? It's no insult,
Hardwick grunted, gulping down the rest of his drink.
She's been married, so you know she ain't untouched. But she hasn't gone and...
Stop now,
Michael ground out.
Hey, everyone is saying it.
Not in my presence,
Michael bit off.
Not if they value their health.
Well, it's better than saying she ain't like a virgin,
Hardwick chortled.
If you know what I mean.
Michael lunged.
Good God, man,
Hardwick yelped, falling back onto the floor.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Michael wasn't certain how his hands had come to be around Hardwick's neck, but he realized he rather liked them there.
You will never,
he hissed,
utter her name again. Do you understand me?
Hardwick nodded frantically, but the motion cut off his air even further, and his cheeks began to purple. Michael let go and stood up, wiping his hands against each other, as if attempting to rub away something foul.
I will not countenance Lady Kilmartin being spoken of in such disrespectful terms,
he bit off.
Is that clear?
Hardwick nodded, and so did a number of the onlookers.
Good,
Michael grunted, deciding now was a good time to get the hell out. Hopefully, Francesca would already be in bed when he got home. Either that or out. Anything. As long as he didn't have to see her. He walked toward the exit, but as he stepped out of the room and into the hall, he heard his name being uttered yet again. He turned around, wondering what man was idiot enough to pester him in such a state. Colin Bridgerton, Francesca's brother. Damn!
Kilmartin,
Colin said, his handsome face decorated with his customary half-smile.
Bridgerton!
Colin motioned lightly to the now overturned table.
That was quite a show in there.
Michael said nothing. Colin Bridgerton had always unnerved him. They shared the same sort of reputation, that of the devil-may-care rogue. But whereas Colin was the darling of the society mamas, who cooed over his charming demeanour, Michael had always been, or at least until he'd come into the title, treated with a bit more caution. But Michael had long suspected there was quite a bit of substance under Colin's ever-jovial surface, and perhaps it was because they were alike in so many ways, but Michael had always feared that if anyone were to sense the truth of his feelings for Francesca, it would be this brother. "I was having a quiet drink when I heard the commotion," Colin said, motioning to a private salon. "Come, join me." Michael wanted nothing more than to get the hell out of the club, but Colin was Francesca's brother, which made them relations of a sort, requiring at least the pretense of politeness. And so he gritted his teeth and walked into the private salon, fully intending to take his drink and leave in under 10 minutes. "Pleasant night, don't you think?" Colin said, once Michael was pretending to be comfortable. "Aside from Hardwick and all that." He sat back in his chair with careless grace. "He's an ass." Michael gave him a terse nod, trying not to notice that Francesca's brother was watching him as he always did, his shrewd gaze carefully overlaid with an air of charming innocence. Colin cocked his head slightly to the side, rather as if, Michael thought acerbically, he were angling for a better look into his soul. "Damn it all," Michael muttered under his breath, and he rang for a waiter. "What was that?" Colin asked. Michael turned slowly back to face him. "Do you want another drink?" he asked, his words as clear as he could manage, considering they had to squeeze through his clenched teeth. "I believe I will," Colin replied, all friendliness and good cheer. Michael didn't believe his facade for a moment. "Do you have any plans for the remainder of the evening?" Colin asked. "None." "Neither do I, as it happens," Colin murmured. Damn, again! Was it really too much to wish for one bloody hour of solitude? "Thank you for defending Francesca's honour," Colin said quietly. Michael's first impulse was to growl that he didn't need to be thanked. It was his place, as well as any Bridgerton's, to defend Francesca's honour. But Colin's green eyes seemed uncommonly sharp that evening, so he just nodded instead. "Your sister deserves to be treated with respect," he finally said, making sure that his voice was smooth and even. "Of course," Colin said, inclining his head. Their drinks arrived. Michael fought the urge to down his in one gulp, but he did take a large enough sip for it to burn down his throat. Colin, on the other hand, let out an appreciative sigh and sat back. "Excellent whiskey," he said with great appreciation. "Best thing about Britain, really. Or one of them, at least. One just can't get anything like it in Cyprus." Michael just grunted a response. It was all that seemed necessary. Colin took another drink, clearly savouring the brew. "Ah," he said, setting his glass down. "Almost as good as a woman." Michael grunted again, raising his glass to his lips. And then Colin said, "You should just marry her, you know." Michael nearly choked.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Marry her," Colin said with a shrug. It seemed simple enough. It was probably too much to hope that Colin was speaking of anyone but Francesca. But Michael took one desperate stab anyway and said, in quite the chilliest tone he could muster,
"To whom, might I ask, do you refer?"
Colin lifted his eyebrows.
"Do we really need to play this game?" "I can't marry Francesca," Michael sputtered.
"Why not?"
"Because..."
He cut himself off. Because there were 100 reasons he couldn't marry her, none of which he could speak aloud. So he just said,
"She was married to my cousin."
"Last I checked, there was nothing illegal in that." No, but there was everything immoral. He'd wanted Francesca for so long, loved her for what felt like an eternity, even when John had been living. He had deceived his cousin in the basest way possible. He would not compound the betrayal by stealing his wife. It would complete the ugly circle that had led to his being the Earl of Kilmartin, a title that was never supposed to have been his. None of it was supposed to be his, and except for those damned boots he'd forced Reavers to toss in a wardrobe, Francesca was the only thing left of John's that he hadn't made his own.
John's death had given him fabulous wealth. It had given him power, prestige, and the title of Earl. If it gave him Francesca as well, how could he possibly hang on to the thread of hope that he hadn't somehow, even if only in his dreams, wished for this to happen? How could he live with himself then?
"She has to marry someone," Colin said.
Michael looked up, aware that he'd been silent with his thoughts for some time, and that Colin had been watching him closely all the while. He shrugged, trying to maintain a cavalier mien, even though he suspected it wouldn't fool the man across the table.
"She'll do what she wants," he said. "She always does."
"She might marry hastily," Colin murmured.
"She wants to have children before she's too old."
"She's not too old."
"No, but she might think she is, and she might worry that others will think she is as well. She didn't conceive with your cousin after all. Well, not successfully."
Michael had to clutch the end of the table to keep from rising. He could have had Shakespeare at his side to translate, and still not have been able to explain why Colin's remark infuriated him so.
"If she chooses too hastily,"
Colin added, almost offhandedly, "she might choose someone who would be cruel to her."
"Francesca?"
Michael asked derisively. "Maybe some other woman would be that foolish, but not his Francesca." Colin shrugged.
"It could happen." "Even if it did," Michael countered, "she would never remain in such a marriage. What choice would she have?" "This is Francesca," Michael said,
which really should have explained it all.
"I suppose you're right,"
Colin acceded, sipping at his drink.
"She could always take refuge with the Bridgertons. We would certainly never force her to return to a cruel spouse."
He set his glass down on the table and sat back.
"Besides, the point is moot anyway, is it not?"
There was something strange in Colin's tone, something hidden and provoking. Michael looked up sharply, unable to resist the impulse to search the other man's face for clues to his agenda.
"And why is that?" he asked.
Colin took another sip of his drink. Michael noticed that the volume of liquid in the glass never seemed to go down. Colin toyed with his glass for several moments before looking up, his gaze settling on Michael's face. To anyone else, it might have seemed a bland expression, but there was something in Colin's eyes that made Michael want to squirm in his seat. They were sharp and piercing, and although different in colour, shaped precisely like Francesca's. It was damned eerie, that.
"Why is the point moot?"
Colin murmured thoughtfully.
"Well, because you so clearly don't wish to marry her."
Michael opened his mouth for a quick retort, then slammed it shut when he realized, with more than considerable shock, that he'd been about to say, "Of course I do." And he did. He wanted to marry her. He just didn't think he could live with his conscience if he did.
"Are you quite all right?" Colin asked.
Michael blinked.
"Perfectly so. Why?"
Colin's head tilted slightly to the side.
"Well, for a moment there, you looked..."
He gave his head a shake.
"It's nothing." "What, Bridgerton?"
Michael nearly snapped.
"Surprised," Colin said. "You looked rather surprised." "Bit odd, I thought."
Dear God, one more moment with Colin Bridgerton, and the bloody bastard would have all of Michael's secrets laid open and bare. Michael pushed his chair back.
"I need to be going,"
he said abruptly.
"Of course,"
Colin said genially, as if their entire conversation had consisted of horses and the weather. Michael stood, then gave a curt nod. It wasn't a terribly warm farewell, considering that they were relations of a sort, but it was the best he could do under the circumstances.
"Think about what I said,"
Colin murmured, just when Michael had reached the door. Michael let out a harsh laugh as he pushed through the door and into the hall. as if he'd be able to think about anything else for the rest of his life.